Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Trinity Church. I'm Sam Lloyd, the priest in charge of Trinity Church, and happy to have you with us for what is always one of the highlights of our fall. We look forward to being able to host some piece of the Boston Book Fair and have a ball doing it. We, as a church, are a place that takes the cultural life of our city very seriously. And there's no better sort of offering of the riches of our culture than what happens in this one day. So we're delighted to have you here with us to be part of it. Trinity carries on a full round of concerts and lectures and presentations, and I encourage you to have a look at our website and some material spread around the church that talks something about the kinds of offerings that we make here. Trinity is an Episcopal church, which means we have our own distinctive way of exploring the mysteries and complexities of our lives, and we invite you to come explore with us if you'd like along the way and join in and see where it takes all of us. But we're here now for a very fascinating conversation called Out of Darkness. We will be hearing from Kim McLaren in just a minute, telling us something about the conversation about to take place. Kim is the author of three novels herself, very well received, and a frequent commentator and reviewer in major newspapers online and variously in the press. So it's great to have Kim with us, and I'll turn it over to her for the discussion.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate it. I'm wondering if you can hear me. Can you hear me? Let me know. Yes, because we're speaking from these Star Trek-esque microphones, which is a little disturbing. So if you see me doing this during the conversation, it's just because it's weird to have this hanging from your ear. Welcome to Trinity Church. Welcome to the Boston Book Festival. We're thrilled to have you here. My name is Kim McLaren. I am the author. My friend Callie Crossley said, make sure you tell him you were a writer too. I'm the author of three novels and a memoir recently published called Divorce Dog. Okay, but enough about me now. We're really here, and I'm very excited and very honored to be in conversation with two extremely talented and accomplished and hot, I would say right now, hot authors. Ayana, I'm sorry. I don't know why I want to say A. Do people do that to you?
People do all kinds of things with an initial vowel when confronted with
it's very challenging. I spent like half an hour last night practicing it, and I still messed it up. Ayana Mathis, and I'm just going to give you a brief bit about each of them, and then we're going to launch into a conversation, and then we're going to open the floor for questions, because we really want this to be a dialogue with you as much as what's going on up here. So Ayana Mathis, of course, is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, very prestigious, and a recipient of the Michener Copernicus Fellowship. Her first novel, of which I'm sure you're all aware, is The 12 Tribes of Hattie, which has received tremendous acclaim, was, of course, picked for the Oprah Book Club 2.0, and is just doing really well. I just wanted to read a couple of very brief blurbs about it so you know. It received a starred review and book list, and it read, writing with stunning authority, clarity, and courage, debut novelist Mathis pivots forward in time, spotlighting intensely dramatic episodes in the lives of Hattie's nine subsequent children, galvanizing crises that expose the crushed dreams and anguished legacy of the Great Migration. We're actually going to talk about that. I understand that there's some issue. We'll talk about that. And the New York Times called the book astonishingly powerful. So we're really honored to have her here. And we're also in conversation, of course, with local boy made good, Paul Harding, who is an American musician and author best known for his debut novels, Tinkers, which, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize. And there's a great story around that. Paul may or may not be sick of talking about how it's the little book that could. And we'll talk about that. But we're also here to celebrate his second novel, very well received, Enon. He is also a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and has taught at Harvard and the University of Iowa. So maybe we could just give them a welcome here to get a little energy into the conversation. All right. It's a different venue to speak so far away from you. I feel like we're a little removed, so I hope that we will feel your energy coming back. I'm from the South, so when I'm in church, I expect there to be noise coming up from the congregation, not like silence, okay? So if you hear something good, say, yeah, amen, okay? So get in here. All right. So I'm gonna jump into it and ask you guys maybe to start about the role of place. I read both novels. I enjoyed them both tremendously. There's so many. There are similarities. There are dissimilarities. I guess the topic of this conversation is supposed to be out of darkness. And I guess the question Paul said earlier, maybe he said people often ask you, why do you write about such depressing things? So maybe let's start by asking, why do you write about such depressing things? I think one of the connections is the inciting incident for both of your novels is the death of a child, which is the most horrific thing, right, than most people can imagine or ever care to imagine. Why was that? How did that come about? Do you feel that's a legitimate question for people to ask you? I'm just going to throw it open to you. So I'll start with you, Ayanna.
Well, I suppose it is a legitimate question, sort of. Well, I'm not sure that the why is everything so sad a legitimate question, though I certainly understand. I don't think of the book as being sad,
no,
actually.
I don't either.
I think of it as being sort of a particular, rather fierce, vision of what someone's life was like. And a somewhat, certainly Hattie, the title character, certainly her life is more fraught than other lives, but I don't think that it is sort of unusually sad. And I also don't think that it is, usually when people say that to me, I think that they are referring to something like despair or bleakness, which I think is kind of completely absent from that novel. Certainly the characters in the novel are struggling. Certainly they're having a very difficult time. But I think of despair as something like a grave, you know, a sort of utter absence of hope. You know, despair, we're in a church, so I may as well. It's sort of in the Catholic, kind of in Catholic theology, despair is one of the seven greatest sins,
right,
you know.
Right.
And the reason that despair is such a great sin, a mortal sin, is because it presumes the inability of God to intervene and change the situation of the despairing person's life. So sort of taking it out of a kind of theological context, because I don't think of it in that way, that's just an example. Taking it out of that theological context, despair certainly is a kind of a grave, a bleakness, an absolute absence of hope. And I don't think that the characters in this novel have that. I think they have their struggles. And I think that they are sustained by moments of beauty. I think they're sustained by all kinds of things, though there is, you know, a great deal of trouble. And in terms of the sort of inciting incident, I guess, the death of the child in the beginning of the novel.
Twins. Hattie has
yeah,
twins.
There's,
and
yes,
they, and
it's
they
not
die.
Just one.
Yes. Double tragedy.
Worse.
Yes. Yes.
Certainly.
And they're very young.
Certainly. They're 6 months
old. They're 6 months old. Which
yeah, it really is kind of horrific. And at the time that I was writing, I thought, this is really an awful thing to do to this woman. But I think in many ways it was necessary. I sort of should explain for people who haven't read the novel. When these twins die, she's 17. They're her firstborn children. And she goes on to live a very long life and to have many more children after that. And she raises these children mostly with metal and not with tenderness at all. And one of the reasons that that happens, there are many reasons, I hate to sort of reduce her to a kind of armchair psychology sort of thing, but one of the reasons that that happens is because she suffers so enormously,
right,
at an age when she herself is still a child. And yeah. So her expectations of the world are somewhat compromised.
Right.
And so she begins to think that the world is not going to meet her or the children she goes on to have with kindness or with tenderness. And so though she loves her children, she raises them to sort of meet tough with tough.
Right. Right.
And in order for, I think, you know, I wasn't so much concerned about her being a likable character in the traditional
right.
sense, but I want people to understand her. And in order for people to understand her, and in order for me to understand her, something difficult had to happen to her at the beginning.
Right. Wow. Okay, so I want to bring Paul in. There's so much that you touched on that I want to touch on. I don't know if we'll have opportunity to talk about it. One of which is this idea of, and you can bring Paul can get in here, how love manifests for some families, perhaps even in some cultures. And I'm not sure, but I think I was told, quite honestly, by your publicist that you're reluctant to talk about the book in terms of representational of a greater experience, which I totally understand. Maybe we can talk about that. But what I thought about when reading the book and talked about her, the way she loves, it reminded me, and I'm sure you've heard this, of Toni Morrison's novels, right? And she talks about how black parents have to love, in some ways, and traditionally have loved their children differently because you have to send them out into a world that's hostile. So that's all very interesting. But let's talk, before we get into that, why don't you jump in there in the conversation?
Well, I mean, a lot of what Ayanna says rings, you know, resonates with me too, because the Enon, the basic dramatic premise is that a father has lost his only child.
Through a tragic accident.
Through a tragic accident. She's struck and killed while she's riding her bike. It's the same thing. You know, people say, "Why do you write such a sad book?" And it's not a book about despair. It's not a book about grief. It's a book about somebody who experiences a tragedy and does the best he can to fend off despair. He spends the book trying to find hope. And when he, this isn't a spoiler alert. You know, he finds it, but when he finds it, it's modest and it's costly. But I had the idea that, like, the deeper the darkness, the more beautiful and piercing the light of hope will be when you finally find it. It would be all the more lucid. And so that's because I it was like Flannery O'Connor or somebody said, you know, like, people don't, you know, hopeless people don't write novels.
No,
you know?
No.
I was thinking,
become hopeless while you're writing your novel. But
right. Yeah. No. Yes. When I went harrowing hell with Charlie, who is the protagonist, I kept saying, "Don't you think we should start turning back up toward the light now?" He's like, "We're not even halfway down yet." But the idea is that he was not going to give in to despair. You know. And speaking theologically, I mean, one of the things I'm always fascinated with is, you know, Martin Luther talks about always trying to, it's almost a moral imperative to always try to find the deep and secret yes of human experience, despite how often we find ourselves in predicaments where you just think there is no yes to this. It's just hopeless. And so the idea of just, of that kind of costly sort of hope. And facing, I mean, the other thing too is, like, why would you want to I wouldn't want to read a novel where sort of like everybody pays their bills on time and the husband's a pretty good cook and the kids are all really get good grades and that's the end.
There's nothing there to write about.
If a book starts off like that, all hell better break loose pretty quickly, and it will. I mean, people.
But do you think? I mean, I agree with you. But do you think Americans in general? I mean, you mentioned that she's not a particularly likable narrator, but she was not unlikable, and that was a problem with you. And I'm sure you're familiar with the conversation earlier this year. Who was the writer?
Claire Massoud.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh,
who
yeah.
had that? Which I thought she had a great, you know, especially women narrators. Mm-hmm. Do you think readers expect female protagonist to be likable, or and to your point, do you think they expect not everything to be perfect, but to at least be to stay on a certain light level? Do you think Americans want comedy? I guess is what I'm asking you.
Enon's a very funny novel. No, it's
totally.
There's some humor.
Yeah,
we're all from here, right? So you'll get it. Get the humor. Go out west, and they're like, I think part of it too is like all the difference in the world is between like a sympathetic character and a character with whom you empathize. Because empathy
different.
Is by far the more the deeper and nobler sentiment. So you may not agree with Hattie or sympathize with what she does, but you understand moment by moment the choices that she's making with the resources that she has. She makes recognizable human choices about the difficulties in her life. And that's how I see it as well. I mean, my character sort of breaks into people's houses and steals their painkillers and, you know, sort of ends up drunk in the graveyard and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, I don't sympathize with that, but I understand,
you understand
how people get to that.
Yeah.
Did you want to?
No, I mean, really basically kind of what Paul was saying. I think it's very, the question of what people expect, I think, is an interesting one. I think the kinds of questions that, so there was this Claire Massoud, who, and I can't remember her book. It came up at, what is it called? I can't remember. It's her newest.
Somebody
really
knows.
Wonderful,
somebody
which you wouldn't think,
because
I can't remember the title of it, but it's really great. And she was asked in an interview by someone about her sort of unlikable female characters, and she got really mad, which was awesome.
Yes.
And was like, "What the hell is the matter with you? Do not ask me about whether my characters are like, why are you asking me this question? It's an absurd question."
And that men don't get asked it.
And men don't get asked this question. So she got really angry, and it was really great. But what I thought was interesting was that I wondered, certainly, you know, sometimes journalists will ask those questions, but I wonder really what people's experiences is when they're sort of in their living room or their bedroom with this book. Like, do they actually think this character needs to be likable, or do they continue to read? Do they sort of, you know, everyone's experience of reading is, you know, you sort of have these cumulative experiences, you know? So you encounter a character and you think, ooh, I don't like this person so much, or, ugh, so annoying, or whatever you think, you know? And then as you keep reading, you sort of accumulate, you accumulate empathy, you accumulate a certain kind of understanding. And so some of the questions that you might have about a character's personality or your relationship to that character, some of those questions you might have in the first 50 pages, you may not have at all by the 300th page, you know? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I wonder, the questions sometimes that are asked to writers by journalists, I think might be very different than the kinds of questions that readers might have in the intimacy of their experience with a novel, in which, you know, and I think sometimes the bar is sort of set lower than it actually is. Mm. You know, it's sort of like that we assume that readers want likable female characters, and readers want happy stories, and readers want all these things. And we have all these projections and marketing things and things that people say, but actually I think that often when people read a novel and when people sort of give themselves over to it, they're looking for something. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're looking for entertainment, just like we all are sometimes. And sometimes they're looking to see some aspect of what it means to be a person being told back to them, to which they in turn sort of enter into a conversation with.
Because and they recognize.
Exactly, because they experience. Recognize something. And then in that case, these questions like, oh, is the character likable? Or are they?
It's irrelevant.
They're irrelevant. And I wonder really, sort of in the deepest kinds of privacy that people have and intimacy with novels, if they really are thinking those
things. Or larger social issues are sort of rhetorically kind of, you know, are posed in the context of the book when it's actually not actually relevant to the book itself.
To the book itself, yeah.
Because the books are, I mean, because this is something that I, you know, the idea too that like, say in the instance of Hattie, she's not, you know, it's not that she's a likable or unlikable female character. She is herself. And I think readers, you know, that process of becoming over 300 pages, becoming fully implicated in her humanity, mm-hmm. is that process that sort of like by the end, a thoughtful reader of a well-rendered book won't even be asking that question. Mm-hmm. You know, won't be able to like generalize about her because it would be as if, you know, the relationship will be complicated and conflicted and ambivalent and passionate like it is with another real human being.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. And so let's talk about the larger sociological issues. And is it a problem if a reader or a journalist or a reviewer sees larger sociological patterns in the individual story? Does that diminish the story? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't. It can.
Let's be specific. The 12 Tribes of Hattie. Hattie has come up from Georgia, mm-hmm. To Philadelphia, which I love. I think the city is rendered incredibly beautifully there. And she is coming at a time when many African Americans were escaping the South, of course. So it's part of the Great Migration, which Isabel Wilkerson wrote so tremendously about, and the warmth of the other suns. Warmth of another sun. And so I think some reviewers have cast this as a great migration story. And I wonder, is that problematic? Does that diminish the story? Is that what your concern is about that?
I don't, you know, my concern is not so much that it diminishes this story per se. Certainly the Great Migration is a part of this book. You know, she leaves Georgia in 1923 and she comes to Philadelphia. And she is very overt. I mean, the reason that her family, her father was a blacksmith and her father was killed by white men and they sort of took over his shop, etc. And so you know, there are very overt racial reasons for, right. you know, and political and social reasons for them having left at the time they did. And they absolutely are a great migration family. My issue is not that. My issue is that, and I think the issue in general, which extends sort of beyond my novel, is that what we tend to do is, I think that we tend to decide that we have these sort of universal stories, right? You know, and so we'll say, whatever, Anna Karenina. I'm not comparing myself to Tolstoy. I'm just sort of using as an example.
Why not? Okay.
Just want to clarify. So we'll say this is a universal story about, you know, all kinds
right,
of things.
Right.
And so we have all this literature that we sort of classify as universal stories about all kinds of things, and we can all access them because they're universal and they tell about the human experience, and it's all really grand and wonderful. And that is, of course, very true. And then we have other literature that we kind of put inside little fences, and we say, this is a novel that's about the Great Migration, therefore it's about the black experience in the United States. And this is a novel about being Puerto Rican and whatever, and this is a novel about being gay here. And we those novels are denied universality. And so that's the issue. The issue is not, certainly not, that the Great Migration is of all, of course it is, and the Great Migration is enormously important, and I talk about it almost every time I talk about this book, but to sort of to cast it as a book about the Great Migration and entirely representational of, I think, is to limit its limit our sort of perception of it as part of a literature that is universal. And
but is that the fault of the literature or the fault of, let me say broadly, American readers? Because we certainly speak about Philip Roth as being a Jewish writer, and yet people don't not read him because he's a Jewish writer. So I agree what you're saying, but I wonder if, I mean, if the question is, can African-American literature be grounded in African-American experience and also be universal? And of course, why not? Is what's stopping it from being? I hear what you're saying, right? Does that question make sense?
No, it makes total sense. I think that what stops it is certainly readers to some extent, but I also think that, then we could sort of get into a really long conversation about racial politics.
Sorry.
but certainly the way things are cast, the way things are marketed, the way that they're presented to readers is a huge part of the problem.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So instead of kind of being like, here's a book about a family, and they did this, and they did that, and they go, and they say, we say, oh, there's a book about a black family. And then everyone goes, oh, it's a book about a black family. It's a black book. And we go,
it's true.
And okay, so I'm going to read a black book, you know, and it becomes, it's ridiculous. Really ridiculous.
Yeah. And then they read it and they say, boy, that wasn't as black as
I thought. I don't know, I don't know.
I was expecting all kinds of stuff.
It has to do with sort of like the second rate degraded way that, you know, you can't, if your book was about the Great Migration, it would be nonfiction.
Exactly.
I mean, this is the way that novels work, which is that they're about people, they're about human souls, human hearts, and then, but then subsequently, people also have to try to find a way to describe things, to paraphrase it, and so they put it in a genre or in one of these little cubby holes or whatever, and it sort of just gets like it doesn't take the art, the aesthetics of novels on its own terms, because I get the same thing, which is just like, oh, you wrote a book about grief.
Yeah.
I didn't write a book about grief. I wrote a book about a guy named Charlie Crosby who's grieving the death of his daughter. And the difference between thinking that he's the subject and grief, you know, and grief is the predicate rather than grief is the subject, and then he's just a little paper doll I staple my abstract ideas about grief to, is makes all the difference in the world. Because if it was about grief, it'd be like Huber Ross, right, or whatever, chapter one, denial. It would make a terrible novel, you know.
Because
novels don't work by, they're not rhetorical. They don't work by argument. You know, they work, they're experiential. You sit in Hattie's house or you sit in Charlie's house and you watch them and you live with them, and it's an aesthetic thing rather than a rhetorical thing. It's not argumentative, it's not theoretical, it's not abstract, it's imminent.
Mm-hmm.
The writer puts you in their imminent physical experience and you just experience life with them. And then cumulatively you almost vicariously live their lives with them, or at least alongside them.
Right. Absolutely. And it's the same thing, you know, I mean, I know we're sort of talking about sort of these classifications, but I think also the notion of the sort of politically motivated novel, which is sort of, you know, James Baldwin has this really great essay called Everybody's Protest Novel, and which is basically like, you know, and he does it, you know, and he sort of talks about how, he talks about a great many things about how they're reductive and how they don't actually really sort of help things at the end
of the day. They're just propaganda.
They're just propaganda, and that they sort of reduce the experience of whatever is being protested against into something that becomes something like the status quo at the end of the day. Do you know what I mean? That we sort of rely on a particular narrative of a particular bad experience. And then we're all like, well, we know that. I'm just really sad and moving on, you know?
Right.
But he also sort of says something just about language, and he talks about how protest, I wish I could remember the quote, but he says something to the effect of, you know, that these novels are because of their sort of lofty goals, they're forgiven whatever murderous things they do to language, you know, and it's so there's also that.
Yes. And at the same time, James Baldwin called for a profound articulation of the black experience.
Exactly.
Precisely. Right. Right.
But that is not reductive.
Exactly. Which is not reductionist. Exactly. Right. Which is what I think your novel accomplishes so beautifully.
Well, thank you.
So what you were talking, Paul, earlier about, I just lost the train of thought, but I was wondering, you talked about the experiential nature of a novel. And I'm wondering, when do you know you have a novel for both of you? How does the seed come to it? It's not, you don't say, I'm going to write a novel about grief, and then, like you said, you know, staple it to the character. Right. Right. So where...
That's totally what Paul did. He called totally. Me. He's like, I'm going to write a novel about grief.
Yes. Ayana.
And next, do you have a basket and you have an emotion and you pick out an emotion? Next,
Ennui. That's book three. Book three will be about Ennui. Great.
So how do you know when you have a novel? Do you ruminate?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, what I do is, I go for long periods where, to all appearances, I'm napping. You know, I just like lie on the couch.
It's a great thing about being a writer.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Because my wife says, "What are you doing?" I'm writing.
I'm working.
And I usually have a very impressive looking book, sort of tented up. You know, but what I do is I read a little bit of something that's kind of suggestive and interesting, and then I just ride the updrafts. Mm. You know, I just sort of just put myself in this sort of system. And with Enon, anyways, it just came to me as a visual image. I just had a just this visual image, almost like it was like a black piece of paper that had like that was cut out in silhouette. Who's the woman that does those silhouettes?
Tara Walker.
Yeah, and it was, you know, that's a different subject matter, but you know, it was just a silhouette of a kind of an exaggerated hillside that was studded with headstones, and there was this single figure sort of creeping across the top of the. Top of the hill, you know, underneath the stars and the moon, and I knew all at once that it was the Enon Cemetery, that the guy going across the hill was Charlie Crosby, that he was going home after a night of misadventure, that his daughter was buried at the bottom of the hill, and that he was sneaking behind her grave because he was ashamed of what had happened to him since she died. And so just from there, it just starts to, I just, you know, just unfolded almost image by image, sentence by sentence from
And when
there.
You said you knew he was Charlie Crosby, you mean he's the great-grandson of the protagonist of your first novel.
Of the first novel,
novel.
I knew it was going to be in the same world.
You knew there was the connection. Yeah. Wonderful. What about you? How does it...
Well,
that's a tough question, I know.
I know. Well, unlike Paul, I've only done this once. I think... Hattie was... slightly, I wouldn't say accidental, but I didn't know that I was writing a novel. And I guess this is maybe the big difference between first and second novels, is that the first time, I think a lot of people don't necessarily, you know, you start writing something. I thought that I was writing some short stories because I was getting an MFA and I had to have some work.
to get that degree.
So I thought, okay, well, because I had this other novel idea, and then it was really bad and stupid. So I had to abandon it because Marilyn, our mutual idol, was like, no. So
Marilyn Robinson.
And so after I had sort of a major crisis, then I kind of started working on something else, and I thought that they were stories. And then by the time I got to maybe the third or fourth one, Paul was actually my teacher the second semester. I realized that. I realized that I did indeed have a novel, so that was different. And this time, I'm finding it very different because I have a very good, sort of good, strong idea. But it's interesting to sort of set out with intent. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wish it could all be accidental all over again. Every time, I could just be like, oh my gosh, a book. You know,
right.
not that it was that easy. But you know what I mean? I had like a good 70 pages before I read. It was very different than being like, I'm going to write a book now. Which is really quite daunting, but I feel like I've been fortunate. I do the same thing. I go to sleep a lot, and I'm not ostensibly napping. I actually am napping.
You actually?
I'm actually napping. And I read a lot, and then something sort of comes or sticks, and it sort of sweeps me up. Or music, and this book that I sort of have an idea about, music is a big part of, and so I've sort of become obsessed with a lot of very early blues singers, and I listen to this music a lot, and it's sort of, you know, it's all sort of I'm pretty language driven in the beginning, and very language driven. I was a failed poet for a long time, and so a lot of times what motivates me is just sort of the sound of language, you know, and so I listen to these songs, or I'll read poetry, read a lot of poetry, what I end up with is sentences or paragraphs or fragments that I have no idea what to do with them or where they fit in, but they begin a process.
Wonderful. Well, you're in good company, as you know. James Baldwin was listening to blues singers in Switzerland, right, when he finished. He said that's what allowed him to finish Go Tell It on the Mountain, his first novel. He was in this very white literally place. And he said it was listening to Bessie Smith that allowed him to do it. So that's tremendous. You mentioned, and I think we're probably going to get to conversation. We're going to get to questions from the audience after this. But I did want to touch on this very briefly, just because you mentioned the way the first novel being kind of found. It took a lot of work to find it, but now having to be intentional. And I wonder for both of you, too, I was thinking about this. You've both received such tremendous acclaim. I mean, this is your second one, but your first one won the Pulitzer. I mean,
it's all
wow.
Downhill from
wow, that. Right? Well, I mean, do you worry? That's the question, right? Do you worry about that? I think reading about both of you, of course, I thought about the great line from Breakfast at Tiffany's, right, where the writer says, you know, I was called that worst of all possible things, promising, and he never, you know, and he hasn't written since then, right? You know, Paul, and so. How do you negotiate that? Do you not deal with it? Do you not take it on? You know, the tremendous acclaim also might come with something else, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it took me forever to get Tinkers published, and I got a lot of rejections for it and all that sort of stuff. So I spent 4 or 5 years with the book in the drawer. Four or five years with the book in the drawer and just writing for writing's sake. And that's something that all of our, I think, probably, you know, our best teachers always told us anyways, I think, is don't mix up writing with publishing.
Right.
You know, writing is not a means to anything
don't
else.
Don't do that.
It's the thing itself. So I spent 4 or 5 years just, you know, thinking I might be a writer who never gets published. So that when Tinkers was published, it was just all gravy from there, you know. And then, like, to win the Pulitzer, you know, for your first book and all that, it's sort of, I was lucky. I was kind of deep. I was sort of 100 pages into Enon when it won the prize, and I had I just had the ability to just when I sit down, you know, when I sit down to write, I can just make the whole world go away, you know,
right.
And just be down in the work of art, as it were. And then, you know, so there were nights, you know, as a private citizen, you know, at 4 a.m, I'd be going, oh, Pulitzer, how am I going to do this? But then the better part of me would say.
I think I got an email from you in the middle of one of those
nights. I don't know. But then the better part of me would say, you should be so lucky that your biggest problem in life is like following up your Pulitzer Prize winning debut novel. Like,
yeah, right.
Come on. Kidding me. So it's sort of one of the because part of that is it's just all the outside, you know, and prize winning is a very rowdy partisan sport, you know, and you know half the people when you know Tinkers won the Pulitzer thought it was the end of civilization, and the other half, you know, probably thought it was perfectly fine, you know, and so it's just that's all kind of like showbiz in a way, you know what I mean? It's just it's like the writing is a whole different, you know, the art, making the art, the writing, that kind of thing is just it's just a different realm, you know, and then the public, and I love it. I mean, I love going out and going on book tours and getting to do all these great events and all that sort of stuff, but you just can't worry about that that kind of stuff, you know. I don't know. What do you think?
Sort of the same thing. I mean, I suspect that I'm still sort of in a very kind of incubation stage with the second book, and so now it's very easy to not think about what will people think and what will I do and will it be blah blah blah. It's very easy to not think about that. I'm sure that once the manuscript is done and it sort of goes to the publisher, then I'll have like a series of breakdowns every day in which I'm like, everyone's going to hate it. Why does it? And, you know, and there was no Hattie. I mean, this one, what's her name? Maybe it should end with IE. People like that sound. You know, I don't know, whatever. right. I'm sure I'll have, you know, a million things like that. But in the meantime, it is basically, as Paul was saying, it's such an intimate process. And it's also so difficult and miserable that it's really hard to kind of the sheer effort that it takes to sort of do it tends to squeeze out other kinds of concerns simply because it just takes so much effort to do it.
Right.
And that is sort of a wonderful, I think, saving grace.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, great. Why don't we open it up for questions and dialogue from the audience? I think there's a microphone. Is that what we're going to do?
Oh,
yes.
Great.
So just if you would like to, I see some hands back there. You could stand up. Yes, thank you. We can't really see you, so
yeah,
that's sorry.
Okay. I prefer that. I was just taking notes. And talking about the universality of a novel, how does the narration of it, first person, third person, different voices, how does that influence the universality of the novel?
I don't know. I mean, I find the kind of old saw about you find the universal in the particular to be true. I just feel like, you know, when I write, I just sort of, I write on the level of the sentence. I'm just listening for what the character is going to say next. Like in Enon, it's a first person narrative, so it's just almost a monologue. It's a soliloquy, and I'm just listening to this person try to account for himself. And so I just didn't worry about, again, if I was worried about grief per se, I'd be constantly testing what he said against what I thought about what's universally true of grief. Mm. Whereas if I write it from the inside out and just let him account for it, then it will be actually more accessible, more universally accessible, relatively speaking, to other people, because it will be, the universality will come in how highly articulated his experience is, and how what it feels like to go from moment to moment, to sort of have a moment of respite and then suddenly be plunged back into it, be wanting to be able to get an arm's length away from the loss of his daughter, remembering it all over again, just those moments, because people just, the universality is just in the persistence of the feeling over time, and how you try to like improvise your way through each moment of that kind of grief, rather than, oh, well, his impulse was to curl up into a ball, whereas most people would, they'd turn outward toward the community. No, they would, unless, of course, they don't. And that's the sort of thing. So there's no way that you can sort of say, well, when one of the cliches about grief, say, is that something terrible befalls you and the entire world changes. And really, it's sort of like what's so painful about it is that the world doesn't change at all. Right. You've changed completely within the world, but the paper boy still whips the paper into the backyard, and the mailman still brings the mail late, and you still have a tough time, whatever, and so you just have to write it from the inside out,
I think I was about to sort of essentially repeat what Paul said, but specificity, I think, is what is the name of the game, absolute and utter specificity to the psyche, personality, etc., of the character in their situation. And I don't think, in terms of the sort of first, point of view kind of asked part of the question, I don't think that there is a point of view that is ever sort of better than one other. The only sort of criteria for which point of view is better for whatever situation is whatever the story dictates. There are chapters in the book. Most of the chapters are in the third person. There are a couple that are in the first person, right, because that particular character's story at that particular moment required sort of a super, super immediacy. And then other times it doesn't. I mean, I think I always stick very close to the characters. That's sort of my tendency. I don't sort of tend to use these grand, lofty third persons. I admire them very much. The sort of 18th, 19th century novel. But I can't. Yeah, but it's just not my. It is not my ability to do that. But certainly, I don't. Again, I don't think that it's. I don't think universality is achieved or not achieved by use of the person. I think that specificity is what one is always after, and then what comes after that is what comes after it.
What do you think of you've taught, Paul? What do you think of second person? I had this spate of students I teach to who wanted to do second person. I'm just curious what you would say.
Well, second person can be, it's just very manipulative, because you're insisting that the reader go through a certain experience.
Yes, I resist it. I hate books in second person.
But it can be used, if you use it judiciously, and make claims of, fact rather than value. You stand up and you walk over here and you see this. Okay. Mm. You hate President Obama, and I just say, no, I don't.
Exactly.
And the reader just leaves.
That's always my problem. It's like claims that's always my problem with second person.
You have to be very careful. But sometimes it's immersive. Just a way of like pointing the reader to look at certain things, as long as the reader doesn't feel like she's being manipulated. That's the whole thing, is readers just don't want to feel like they're being jerked around. They want to feel like they're being told everything in good faith.
Yeah. Right. It's really, because it's advertising language. Like this. Yeah. You do that, but if you use it.
Be yourself. Drink Coke.
Exactly.
Other questions? Gentlemen back there.
Uh, Okay, I'm not quite sure how to formulate this, but you spoke at the beginning about likable and unlikable characters, and how over the course of 300 pages, the reader begins to empathize and understand characters better, and it becomes less of an issue as time goes on. And I'm just wondering if isn't it possible in novels for characters to, once they're sort of revealed, more layers are peeled back, you might actually come to the conclusion at the end that you like them less than you did at the beginning. In other words, I understand this character better, but I still don't like them. So just commenting on that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think, sure. I mean, anything's fun. I mean, as a writer, I want to be able to just, whoever kind of comes up on the page, and if they, you want to keep all possibilities open. But I think a book in which you like the character less and less and less, I mean, I wouldn't want to write that book.
Yeah.
I don't want to spend 5 years of my life with a character who I just dislike more and more.
Right.
I don't write about characters I don't like, and I think there's a difference between, I was thinking, of course I have St. Paul on my mind. I mean, one of the things that interested me, Charlie and Enon does unlikable things, he abuses drugs, he breaks into his neighbor's houses, he lets himself go, the house falls down around him, all that sort of stuff. But he has a conscience. Mm. So there's that, it's like St. Paul in the Letter to the Romans, he says, the evil which I do not want to do is what I do, and the good I mean to do is that which I don't, or whatever. Sorry, St. Paul, that was a bad paraphrase. But just that idea, the constant idea of just like that you know better than how you act. Mm. And to me, that was the interesting thing. So like Charlie, what he's doing is not likable and nobody would approve of it. But when they watch him saying, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be doing this. I got to put the booze away. I got to stop breaking into people's houses. Yet here I am like jimmying the lock and going through the window again. Like that, I mean, because we all, that's a universal human experience, from the most trivial examples every day to the most morally profound. Like, I shouldn't have that big piece of chocolate cake. I shouldn't smoke the cigarette. I shouldn't have betrayed my spouse. I shouldn't have left my brother by the wayside. And so you can be doing those things that are unlikable, but a recognizable human being is doing them, and sort of, and if the person's not a sociopath or whatever, in which case it's sort of not interesting. It's
right.
Too simple. You want to have that leeway for just, because I just don't think about likability. I think about complexity. I think about trying to get something like a real human being on the page. And that complexity includes ambivalence about the character. There are better and more and less likable qualities, better and worse impulses that exist in the same person at the same time.
Very good. Other questions? Yes. There's two.
So in the beginning you briefly mentioned the importance of place, and
yes.
So specifically with Tinkers and Enon, I'm from Maine, so I thought the connections you brought up with Maine were really they're really good. They really it felt like Maine to me. So I was just wondering what as you're writing, how does place create the story, and how does story create the place? Because you're physically describing it, but you're also characterizing the people in it, the events in it, through the place. So I'm wondering how it kind of factors in.
Your question contains the answer. No, it's true. Well, I just write about landscapes that I've spent most of my time in. So I spent a lot of time up in northern Maine with my grandfather, who's from there. And Enon is actually the colonial name for Wenham, Massachusetts, which is just up on the North Shore. Mm-hmm. It's where I grew up. With Enon, anyways, in particular, I used the landscape, the local landscape of where I grew up, partly because when I first got the idea for the book, I thought, oh, I've got a good spooky Hawthornian ghost story on my hand. And then I wrote the first paragraph and realized, no, I've got this like heartbreaking tragedy where one false move in any direction, I'm going to lapse into sentimentality, bathos. It's going to turn. So what I realized is I had to listen with the utmost intensity and intimacy to what Charlie was telling me. And so I used a local landscape, all of the details. Like, I know what the light looks like, the seasons are like almost day to day. I know what the people are like, the architecture, everything, so that I wouldn't have to put him on hold and have to go research, like, oh, would he be looking at a yellow rose if this was in Arkansas? So it's just the milieu is just like right at my fingertips. so that I could just, whatever he told me, I could immediately precipitate into that local, that landscape. Mm. And then in terms of landscape and setting, I mean, I always tell, you know, landscape for me is always telescope through character. It's all, you know, so I don't write about landscape per se. It's always the landscape is refracted through the character's point of view, and that angle of refraction is characterization. It's always the experience or the perception of a landscape through a character. So that the landscape, you know, like in Enon, I think of the town as another character. In a way.
I think James actually said landscape is character.
Yeah, I think that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
What about you? Thank you for bringing that question up, because I did want to get back to that. Place is so important in both of your works.
Yeah. I think, I mean, very, very much the notion of place as characterization is enormously important. Sort of unlike, you know, in Tinkers, for example, you know, I mean, Paul spends a lot of time sort of describing nature very, very, you know, but that's all, you know, the Georgics and all these kinds of things are, you know, all that stuff.
Pastoral.
And pastoral, sort of pastoral experience and all this kind of stuff. And my novel obviously is sort of set in the city and it's urban. And there is not as much time sort of spent describing physical landscape, sort of the physical attributes of the landscape. But there is I always have trouble describing this. There's a kind of spirit of Philadelphia-ness that runs through the novel and runs through the characters. You know, they have their sense of place is transmitted, I don't think so much, obviously, as I was just saying, through the descriptions of the places where they are, as it is through the description of their relationship to the place and their relationship to each other.
And also the
fact of place, to get to this kind of idea of the Great Migration, the fact of place sort of ripples through the novel, because the fact of place is incredibly important. The fact of place is the fact that one place was left to seek another place.
Right.
And to sort of establish oneself or build some kind of nation or build some sort of something in another place. And so that fact, having been established very early on, continues, I think, to ripple through the novel.
Right.
And because it was sort of established so firmly so early on, it was less necessary for me to do lots of kind of repeating details of Philadelphia. Also, that doesn't tend to be my inclination as a writer is not necessarily to talk about landscapes a great deal. But when I do, as Paul was saying, this idea of characterization is incredibly important. How a character sees, you know, we could all walk past a White House standing on a hill. And if we are grieving, we see that house in one way. And let's say it's sunny and there's bright sunlight and the sun is gleaming off of the windows. And if we're grieving, this seems an indictment and it seems a burning and it seems something horrible. And if we're really happy that day, it's beautiful. Or if we're really jealous, we think, oh, my neighbor has a house like that and I hate her. You know, all of this stuff is being sort of refracted through who a character is in their state of being at the moment that they see whatever it is that they're seeing. And so landscape, I think, plays an important part in that.
I remember a moment early in obviously in the first chapter, because she's Hattie is trying to nurse her children back to health, and they have pneumonia, so they're stuffed, and she goes out to get eucalyptus leaves. Mm. And she just one line, but I think it encapsulates what you're saying. She said she had to buy them what she could have had for free in Georgia, right? Because in Georgia, you know, she would have picked it. So I think it's beautifully rendered, and a sense of both place and displacement is really important. So great question. There was someone over here. Yes, sir. Yes. We might be able to hear you.
Sorry. Hi. My name is Aisha.
Sorry. No, wait one second. He was next, and then I'll have you. Sorry. Yeah. He had his hand up before, but we could probably hear you. The acoustics here are fabulous. So, and then we'll get to you.
Hi. I was wondering, so you were both discussing earlier how hopeless people do not write novels, which is an idea that I really love. But you both have these characters who are dealing with very tragic things that have happened in their lives. I was wondering if you could talk about, as you're unpacking how these characters are dealing with grief and trying to fend off despair, if that grows taxing for you as writers, as you're trying to inhabit these characters, how you either, if you distance yourself from it or if you fully ingrain yourself in it, and what that experience is like for you as the people bringing these stories out of these characters.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
In my case, you know, Charlie, c'est moi, you know, as Flaubert said of Madame Bovary. I couldn't distance myself from him at all. I basically wore his nerves for 4 years. I just, you know, because I just, that's part of my loyalty. I mean, if I chose to give him such a difficult life and then put him through the paces of it. I had to be right there with him. I couldn't dissociate myself from him. But then, I mean, that has to do also with sort of, in my opinion, I couldn't see the reason why I would ever attempt a novel where anything less than everything was at stake. I mean, my novels are, you know, reflections of what keeps me up at night, you know, and I have friends, dear friends who have lost children, and I worry for them at night, and I have children, and when my first son was born, it was the first time I realized something could now happen to me, you know, could happen in this world where if I lost my child, I'd go out in the backyard, dig a hole, climb in it, and cover myself up. You know, and so just working out these inexhaustible subjects, you know, these subjects that I can't, you know, they're mysteries to ponder but never to solve. They're irreducible. Hmm. They're part of the irreducible sort of complexity and struggle and work of being a human being. It's not easy being a human, you know, and so I just feel like I could never write about a character who's, you know, with whom I could not fully cast my lot.
I had moments when I was working on Hattie where I would become sort of deeply emotional. When her children died, that was a very, that was sort of really intense, and I felt it very acutely, and there are other moments in the novel that I might feel very acutely. More often, though, I tend to, I'm in a kind of state in which I'm aware that I am writing about the things that are most important to me, and there is something that happens that there's a slight gap that opens between me and what I'm writing on the page, even though I am actually aware that I'm writing about what is most important to me and what is most powerful to me. It's very strange. I have a very hard time explaining it, but it's almost as though, I don't know if it's out of self-protection, that there is an awareness that I'm writing about something that is probably acutely painful to me, but that in order to actually be able to write the sentences in some way that is coherent, there something opens so that I have a little bit of distance.
Yes.
Because otherwise I don't think I could actually write the sentences.
Right.
Right.
And it might not be very good if you did.
If I did write the sentences.
In that place.
I mean, I think of it a lot. I mean, and sometimes the writing itself is the medium which makes it dealable. You know, you can actually negotiate it. Because I think of it in terms of, I mean, in Enon, this is what I have my character do, but I think this is just kind of generally what art does too, which is that I often think of like the Medusa and Perseus, which is if you look at these things straight in the eye, they'll turn you to stone. You'll perish. You won't be able to survive the grief, the whatever. But if you take that mirror, which is telling stories, putting things into language, and, you know, if you negotiate these things through something like art, you negotiate them aesthetically, in our case, you know, you can negotiate those most difficult things without just turning to stone.
I have a lot of difficulty with plot, because really I could just sort of have a character sit in a room for 200 pages thinking thoughts.
Ruminating.
You know, and they could just kind of go on and on like that, you know. But one of the things that I have found in my sort of difficulties with plot, one of the things I've come to sort of embrace about, I mean, obviously it's necessary. I mean, something has to happen. Well, arguably. I mean, if you're writing kind of realist fiction in these terrible categories, but whatever, fine. Something has to happen. And for a long time, this seemed like a terrible burden to me. And then in other ways, so I've come to think that it's wonderful because it is also, you know, sort of the act of writing the sentences, as you were saying, is what sort of what puts that gap so that you don't have to sort of stare at the Medusa straight on. But also the idea that a certain set of actions have to occur. And so that whatever it is that I am sort of so deeply feeling or sort of head up about, and that is so deeply powerful to me, can be somewhat, it's not diminished, it's not diluted, but sort of, they can be given a vehicle. Mm-hmm. And that vehicle is not just my characters, which are of course the most important things, but a vehicle that it has an even sort of third degree of distance from me, which is the actions that happen to them and the things that they do.
It's
like 2 degrees of separation.
Right.
1 degree is the character, and then the other degree is what the character does.
Right.
I've come to sort of really be endeared to it and to find it to be very helpful and saving in certain ways.
All right. I think we have time for one more question. So this young lady here.
Actually, it wasn't a question. It's more of a statement. I'm sort of an
unpublished writers. So to hear you guys speaking,
you're a writer. Just say I'm a writer.
I'm a writer. I am a writer.
Yeah. Yeah, you're a writer. That's it. There you go.
And to hear you guys say the things that you're saying, like I feel like writing is such a lonely process because I can't pass it off. I can't delegate it because I'm feeling not, you know, like what you said, staring the Medusa in the eyes, but I am her, and I'm trying to explain who she is and what she's feeling mm-hmm. to everyone else. So even though it's sort of like a lonely process, it's also sort of like the only time I feel like I'm doing something I should be doing is when I'm writing. When I'm not writing, I feel like I should be writing. And so it's like my
statement. Well, let me help you. One thing is that if you're a writer, you're always writing. It's yes. just that you're not always typing.
Exactly.
I mean, because I don't actually type words for months on end. You know, I think the trick is too if you're a writer and you're trying to like figure your way out in the world or whatever, one of the most dangerous things as a teacher, but also as a student, is to like come up with some weird normative model of how you have to be in order to be a real writer. Mm-hmm. Because like our teacher, Marilyn Robinson, you know, like she starts with sentence one, you know, of chapter one, and she writes through, she doesn't revise. And if she gets to page 300 and it doesn't work, she throws out the whole book and starts again.
Of course, it never doesn't work.
And so that's even more intimidating.
But it only takes 18 months.
Right. But if I had to write that way, I'd be your plumber.
Yeah, so yeah.
You know what I mean? You have to get it done. You get it done anyway, and don't hold it against this sort of like, oh, but a real writer wouldn't be doing that. And then, I mean, because we're talking about universality and empathy and who, you know, the Medusa and all this sort of stuff. One of the things I always tell, it's kind of counterintuitive in a way, but one of the things I always tell my writing students is don't write your books for the people who aren't going to like them. Write your books for people who are going to like them. And don't write your books for stupid readers. Write your books for smart people who want to have their brains filled. You know, you want to give your writer a feast, you know? And just don't worry about that other stuff because it'll happen. You're going to get knocked around in public, you know? I write my books for the people who like them.
There you go.
Strangest thing, you know.
Great. Did you want to have a last word, Ayana? That's a word of encouragement to their young writers.
It's just, you know, this is the whole thing. You know, I should be writing. I'm not writing. I should be writing. And, I mean, that's, you know, yeah, that just happens. But this was it. You know, and I don't know sort of where you are, kind of in the process of things. But this is very sort of prescriptive advice. But I found it very helpful to me in a very early stage years ago, which is that, you know, so I would think, oh well, you know, I should be writing. I'm not writing. Oh, I have to write. Oh, you know, this sort of big horrible mountain that you have to climb. Like every day, you're like, I have to go up the Himalayas again. You know, and it's very intimidating. And this writing teacher said to me once, he said, just do 15 minutes a day, which was incredible advice because it relieved so much pressure. Everybody's got 15 minutes psychologically and also sort of physically in terms of time. You have 15 minutes and it sort of made the mountain, it reduced it to a scalable size. So
because you only write one sentence at a time. Right. I mean, I do the same thing where I just write a sentence, just work on a sentence, make the sentence true. Mm. That's sort of, because it's a 400-page book, but you don't write it all at once.
You don't write it, exactly.
Right. You don't have to write all 400 pages. For it. Yes, very terrific. Well, thank you so much. It was a wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you all.
Here.
Thank you, Kim.
And
thanks, Kim.
The writers will meet you outside at the tent if you'd like to have your book autographed. So please don't, we're going to have to go straight right out there. Thank you very much.